Hi, welcome to the podcast. I'm here, as always, with John Micton. John, how are you?
Good, Dan. Hope you're feeling better, because I know last time you were kind of under the weather. You said hit you really bad.
I think I had COVID. I still don't feel great after 2 weeks, but I'm feeling much better. I've been up and about today doing stuff, so it feels good.
And we're wearing the same sweater, so we talked to each other before.
for the three people who watch us on YouTube, they can see we're wearing the same.
Actually, it was interesting. I actually went for our YouTube channel. There's some that get a lot of traffic and others nothing. So I wonder if it's topic or anything. I just did a little analysis. It was interesting. So we definitely get much more responses from our podcasts on Spotify and Apple.
You know what we should do as well? We should start posting on LinkedIn. I was at a session at a conference I was at recently. And on LinkedIn, it's much better if we post the... If we upload the video to LinkedIn as opposed to linking to YouTube, you get much more views natively. So we should start doing that as well.
Okay, that sounds good. Yeah. And Dan, I think it's been almost a year and a half, you and I had this great conversation with Ruth Van Raken, who wrote the book on Third Culture Kids. And it was interesting because we both are part of the third culture in the sense we're parents of third culture kids. Mine are adults. Yours are beginning the journey.
Let's go.
And you have the kind of a Polish English mix, but living in the Czech Republic. And I have the Swiss American mix. And then we also had Valerie from Safe Passage and Roots and Boots, and Jane from Globally Grounded and Safe Passages. So we've really talked to quite a few experts on this topic. And, our listeners, and as Dan and I have been saying that, many of us have third culture kids or are third culture kids, but we've never really talked to the actual kids as such. And our two guests are not children anymore, but they're young adults. And Julia and Brogan are with us. Julia actually, interestingly enough, has her own podcast and she can talk about that. And Brogan is now living, I think, in Switzerland, if I'm correct, and also has had many different experiences. And really what we're going to do today is just have the privilege of having you in the room and just asking you a few questions and maybe having that conversation, because I know our audience, third culture kids, that's what most international school teachers are living with. Many teachers themselves are third culture kids. So it's really a topic that resonates with many people. But we, Dan and I, and the International School Podcast have never had the kids or the products. And I don't know what verbiage or term to use. So slap my hand if I'm going down the wrong road here. But anyway, so first of all, welcome, Brogan and Julia. And maybe if you can each give us a 30-second bio so we have a context, and then we'll jump into the conversation. Brogan, do you want to start? Brogan, would you like to give us the little bio? I don't think he can hear us. Julia, go ahead.
Yeah. So my name is Brogan.
Go ahead, Brogan. Yeah.
I think there's a delay. I think Brogan has a delay, I'm guessing.
Okay.
Do you want to go ahead, Julia, first?
Yeah, slight delay.
Sure, I can go for it. Thanks so much, Dan and John, for having us on the podcast. My name is Julia, and I identify as a third culture kid, as someone who was born in Canada to Canadian parents, but soon moved away to Singapore, mainly growing up there, and then finally returning to Canada again for my university studies. So kind of having that mix of cultures and identities of growing up outside of my passport country. And now I'm in Switzerland studying for my master's. And as John said in the intro, I do have a podcast as well called Across Oceans, where we dive into deeper topics surrounding being a third culture kids, or now as we're called, adult third culture kids. John, if you're looking for that term, that's, I guess, now what we are since we're no longer children. That's a little bit about me.
Thank you, Julia. So nice to have you on board. Brogan.
Yeah, so thanks for having me as well. It's actually the first podcast I've been on, so new territory for me. It's very exciting. I was born in Texas. In the States, to Canadian parents. So I've always kind of considered myself as someone who's always been abroad, always been in a third culture. We moved around to Singapore, back to Atlanta. We settled in Switzerland for a while, so where I went to high school. Spent a few years in Montreal for university and found my way back to Switzerland here, where I'm now working full-time in the IT sector.
Cool. Well, thank you. So really, I think, you know, one of the questions is this idea of multiple identities. You know, very likely through the various cultures and experiences and your respective international school education, you really must have shaped your identity. How do you think these different cultures and your experiences have actually made who you are? And how have you balanced those to create that identity that you think is yours? Maybe we'll start with Julia.
Sure. Yeah. I think it's really complex and nuanced. Being a third culture kid in the way that we were, in the sense that we were in different cultures, but also within kind of like an expat community in the countries or places that we were. And so I'd say it's complicated in that sense, because we never fully integrated, at least myself, into Singapore, for example, like fully into the local community, but also things were very transient within the expat community, whether that was friends coming and going or yourselves moving around between these communities. And so you kind of picked up what you could from each of those identities or communities that you're interacting with. And so then having kind of a sense of belonging maybe everywhere, but also nowhere at the same time.
Interesting. Brogan, does that resonate?
Yeah, I think it does. I think it's interesting because you kind of, to add to that, you kind of, I found myself picking up different identities depending on the group I was in. You know, maybe in the international group, I was the Canadian or the American, or, you know, the international group away from Switzerland, I was a Swiss guy. But then, you know, here, if I was going to play football down at the local park, I was the English kid or the, you know, foreign guy. So you kind of find yourself kind of picking up these slight different identities depending where you are and what context you're in.
Dan, how about yourself? Oh, I think Dan froze. We're not having a good day today with our technology. I'll come back to Dan. How about you, about yourself? Do you find that living in the Czech Republic, if you're among Czechs, you're the English person, or do you have these identities? Because you've lived abroad for a long time too.
Yeah, I've lived abroad most of my adult life. I've lived in Australia, I've lived in US, I've lived in Netherlands, lived in Czech Republic. So yeah, I don't know. I think, you know, I've always, like, as much as it's a lot cooler to say that most of my friends have been locals, like most of my friends have been expats everywhere I've lived, you know, that's the reality of it. Mm-hmm. Maybe not the US because it's more, I guess, culturally sort of similar. But, you know, I do have I have a lot of Czech friends. I've been here 18 years. So, you know, it's like I've lived here longer than I lived growing up in England. So it's really like a long time. So, you know, I don't think so. I don't think it's different, because I think that, you know, you tend to hang around with Czech people that speak English, and even though I speak Czech now, but and a kind of foreign thinking and kind of, you know, that have that mentality. So I think it's pretty similar for me, to be honest.
So that multiple identities that, you know, Dan's highlighting his experience, but Brogan, you go and play soccer and you're the English person. Now, I assume being in Switzerland, you speak French. So when you're among Swiss people, do they think you're Swiss? Can you be Swiss?
No, they're not. I only started learning French relatively late. I'm told my accent is very obvious. So they can tell almost right away that I'm a native English speaker. And I think at first, and maybe just it was just a fact of being a kid, there was a little bit of a feeling of otherness there. But I think I've been here now almost 10, 12 years, and it's definitely been easier, at least to navigate being, you know, maybe not entirely fluent or not entirely Swiss, or speaking the same or coming from the same place as other people.
It's interesting as well, though. I don't know what you all think, because it's not something that international schools really say when they promote themselves, but the reality is international schools are a pretty bad place to learn languages. If you look at, I know people in Prague who've gone through their entire schooling from K through 12 in the Czech Republic, and they don't speak Czech properly, you know? Mm-hmm. There's plenty of kids at ISP that are like that, Riverside, where my kids go. So it's like, and a lot of teachers don't really, you know, because they're very much in the school bubble. Do you guys find that's an issue in the schools you've been at?
Absolutely. I would say in Singapore, I studied Mandarin for the 10 years that I lived there, but it was a very school environment where everyone's speaking English, or even Singapore itself. Yes, Mandarin is one of the official languages, but it's not spoken on the streets. And so there would be times even where I'd want to practice with like a shopkeeper or bus driver, and I mostly just get laughed at for being this foreigner trying to speak Mandarin. But yeah, it made me not really ever become that fluent or that proficient, because I wasn't speaking it on the daily basis. And now I feel sad because I feel like I'm losing a lot of my Mandarin, and it's something I did identify with for a long time, like studying this language for so much of my childhood, and then now just kind of letting it slip away. It's a bit disappointing.
Yeah, you can get it back though. I mean, you could, you know, you could focus on studying it again.
Sure, of course, yes. But I also like realize how much of a privilege now it was being at a international school where I did know the dominant language. Like coming in, it was an English speaking school. I knew English, like compared to other TCKs whose native language might not have been English, like how much more of a challenge that would have been. So there's that whole side of it as well, like what where you're coming from in that way.
Yeah, absolutely. That's challenging.
And curious, out of the two, just a little side point, like which school did you go to in Singapore? I was just there recently, and it's fascinating just because how big the schools are. And Jonathan, not sure if you know, but like a lot of the schools there are 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 students. They're kind of like university sizes, quite a few of them. Did you two go to one of the larger schools?
Yeah, so my parents are actually international teachers themselves. Yeah. And so we followed whichever school they were working at. So initially we were at the International School Singapore, and that was smaller and a lot more international. And then we moved to the Singapore American School, which was giant 4,000 student size school. So yeah, very big.
Yeah, that is really huge. I mean, I was just in like, I think 3 swimming pools, I think 1 or 2, maybe 2 Olympic sized pools are now, and they're building a whole new campus, which is pretty amazing.
Oh yeah, it's massive.
Multiple theaters. I mean, everything. There's multiple everything now. It's not a regular school. Well, what about you, Brogan?
I think he has a little. Brogan, did you go to big international schools too?
In Singapore, we were talking.
I thought it was big till I heard about Julia's school. We probably had I was at actually the International School of Geneva, the Centenary campus. Okay. We probably only had about 100 people in our year, and I couldn't tell you the total students there at one time, but it's definitely less. It's definitely less.
Yeah, I'm sure if you had a school like Julia was, like Singapore American School, it's very much an enclosed. It's like an ecosystem, you know.
Oh, honestly, it almost felt like little America at some times, because there's just so many people and so many Americans, so it's kind of funny.
Sure. Cool. John, jumping onto the second question of talking about challenges and opportunities, so third culture individuals are often influenced by the international school environment and the countries they live in, and of course this leads to challenges and opportunities. So could you share some experiences where your background was shaped by your international schooling or living, and this brought some challenges or opportunities in your personal life?
Brogan, do you want to start?
Yeah, I think definitely I consider myself quite lucky to have been growing up as a third culture kid internationally. I definitely have found I've had a lot more opportunities or let's say different perspectives that have helped me in life. I mean, I think the main thing that pops in my head when trying to answer the question is just adaptability in general. Moving around a lot, and frankly, just moving for university. I know a lot of kids I met who struggled being away from home for the first time, whereas at least I found personally for myself, I was able to adapt quite quickly to being in a new place and being in a different environment. And I attribute that to moving a lot as a kid and just having that ingrained in me that, oh, this is transient. This is new. You have to just you know, you're here now, learn, figure it out.
Yep.
Yeah, I would completely agree with Brogan in the sense that moving around a lot as a kid made it that transition to university for us both back in our passport countries of Canada was a lot easier because we were able to adapt. We were able to make friends more quickly, maybe because we've had to always do that. We're either the new kid or there are always new kids coming and going. But I would say the challenge with that is maybe sometimes not always processing those transitions as a kid. And then it kind of catching up to you later in adulthood, maybe like maybe feeling some of those loss of friendships or loss of identities, like we were talking about earlier, being kind of more of the challenge side of someone who at least had a high mobility as a child.
Yeah, and I know Ruth talked about that, is that often for, in the case of you, Julia, you're a child of international school educators, often you stay longer, so you're always staying there and people are leaving. I don't know, Brogan, were you maybe the person that kept leaving, or were you in schools for a long time too and saw friends leaving, kind of a revolving door for both of you?
Yeah, I moved around mostly between the ages of, I guess, 3 and 13. But really, when we settled here, I was quite settled here between, you know, for my entire middle school, high school career. I was in National School of Geneva. So I was lucky to have, at least in my teens, late teens, be in one spot. But yeah, as you said, I definitely had a lot of friends leave and had to deal with that and have to make new friends quite quickly, being kind of used to a carousel of people. Even if I wasn't leaving, the international community, as you know, is quite, yeah, transient.
Mm-hmm.
Julia, any thoughts about that revolving door of friendships?
Oh, for sure. Like, I was in Singapore for 10 years, really, and I'd say the most developmental part of childhood from 7 to 17. And so in terms of, I guess, how many memories you have. And so, yes, that revolving door of people coming every year, every 2 years, having to make new friends was... of course, exciting because you get to meet new people, but I think over time became a little bit exhausting and sad just to watch your friends always leave. So then when it came to the time to go to university, it was kind of exciting because it was like, oh, I'm finally the one who gets to leave and go off to this new place and make a new life. So yeah, it's very interesting.
It's interesting. I actually, as a parent, it was one of the things I thought about. You know, I looked at the, you know, the turnover rate of students, and it was one of the decision points for me, like getting a school that had the lowest turnover. But you know, even though I say that my kids' school's got like, it's like 7 or 8%, it doesn't sound like a lot, but that means over 10 years, like everyone's gone pretty much. Yeah. You know, it adds up pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Dan, did you do that because you wanted them to have the stability of their long-term friendships?
Yes, exactly. And plus, yeah, exactly. I mean, it was a really tough decision, to be honest, because, you know, we're kind of established in the Czech Republic now, even though we travel a lot. So, you know, we could have sent them to a Czech school, you know, and would have saved a lot of money, and it would be really good, you know. But I kind of like the international school. I've worked with international schools for so long, but I think it's a great experience. I think the experience they have at their school, they wouldn't be even close to getting at a Czech school.
Yeah. So one of the things that I know that my own two children who are TCKs, the home. Where's home? What is home? When do you call home? Do you have a home? I could go on using the word home and kind of, you know, where is home? Or do you find as you're getting older, now you're young professionals and young adults, kind of managing your own lives, you're not dependent on your parents moving. These are choices that you make yourselves. Where is home, Julia?
That is a very good question, John. As many people ask often, it is very complicated. For me, I'd say it's changing all the time. I think it's something that won't be stagnant maybe ever, but I think that's just how it is going to be. But funnily enough, for now, it's Switzerland because I'm living here, and actually my parents are living here as well, and my sister. We all kind of migrated here independently, but we've kind of started to make a life here. And I guess I would say Switzerland for now, but because I did return to Canada For my undergrad, I was able to kind of see what it was like to live there because I didn't really remember what it was like before we went overseas, and kind of make a Canadian home as well. So I'd say I have multiple homes. I don't have one. And then Singapore, in a sense, it feels like a distant home or like a childhood home that you've had to say goodbye to because there's not like a lot of reason to go there anymore. Family has left. All my friends have left. So yeah, I think for now between Canada and Switzerland.
Interesting. Brogan, how about you? If somebody asks you where is home, do you have a different kind of take on what Julia is sharing?
No, I think I feel similar to Julia in that respect on how to answer this question. I've often asked this question, and the short answer is Switzerland. And I say that because it's where I spent most of my childhood. My major formative years were spent here, and my parents still live here. However, you know, if they were to leave and no longer be here, and I was to leave, and I had no family here, I don't think I would still call it home. So in that sense, I don't really think I have a traditional, or we have a traditional sense of home as somebody who maybe was able to grow up in the same place. You know, their parents still in the same place. Yeah, I guess, you know, not to be cliche, but I guess home, I would feel, is where my family is, really. And so it can change.
Do you think for TCKs, that's the worst question to ask? Is it the dreaded question? When you say, for example, dating somebody and you get invited for a meal at their home, or you're in a social situation, or even at a work, you know, you're at a work event and everybody's kind of doing the personal question thing. And then the dreaded question, where is home? Does it feel like that? Or are you like, oh, I'm pretty fluid now. I've got my different choice of answers depending the situation. Julia.
Well, I liked what Brogan had said when he said the short answer is Switzerland. And that's kind of what runs through your mind in these social settings. You're like, do I get the short answer? Or do I get the long answer? Because that really depends on how long we have here to talk about it. And I think it does bring up some anxieties because you have to make that decision. What, like, how much of yourself do you share? Because if you just say Canada, I'm kind of erasing everything about Singapore. But if I say Singapore, then it raises a lot of questions. And so, yeah, it's a bit anxiety inducing, but I think I found a solution. Someone on my Frisbee team, actually, it's a very international group. And one of the members said, I'm from New Zealand via Singapore. And I liked that because it kind of gave note to where you'd been before, but didn't necessarily say, oh, I'm from Singapore or I'm from New Zealand. And so I've started using that. I'm from Canada via Singapore. So
nice.
Maybe there's a hack there.
That's a good one.
Nice hack. Yeah. I like it. Brogan, yeah. So do you also have like a multiple choice of answers pending the situation?
Yeah, exactly. Pretty much. It depends. If I feel someone just trying to make small talk, I'll give them a quick answer. You know, if we have a bit of a longer form conversation, then, you know, I'll delve into, well, actually here. It also depends on where that person is from, because if a Canadian asks me where I'm from, I find it hard to tell them, oh, I'm Canadian. They might ask me, oh, where in Canada? And then you go, well, I actually never lived in Canada. So,
yeah. Totally.
So it's, yeah. It really depends on the situation.
John, what do your kids, because obviously you've got one child in Czech Republic and one in Switzerland. Like, do you think it's kind of random where they ended up, and do they see anywhere as home?
I mean, that's a great question. And, you know, I'm not going to answer for them, but I think definitely Europe is what they were in North America and professionally now have settled in Europe. I think it's also the connection with mother and father and where we are. I think Switzerland is not there. They're Swiss, but they have never really lived here. Well, my daughter's living here, but it's kind of the vacation destination. So it's familiar, but at a very artificial way. And I think my wife is from California, so they've had a lot of experiences in California. Are they American? Maybe in their accent, because there's this kind of international school English accent, which I don't know, it's not English or American, but it's just a very, it's more American-like. Beware, Dan, your kids are not going to have a New Yorkshire accent. So I think for them, you know, I like what you said is home is where maybe the family is or where your current situation is. As you know, some families, like, we have a place that is our home, a physical place that we've purchased, but we've never really lived there. And, you know, now that we're living here, it doesn't really feel like home for them because they don't have the experience. So I think, you know, I hate to put words into their mouth. I'm just kind of guessing. But I would assume that, you know, the connection with the family, the parents, is very strong. Julia, you're talking about that your sister and parents are there, and suddenly that makes it much easier. And Brogan, you also said that your parents are and where you are. So I think that helps. But everything you're saying just resonates so strongly, having had two children go through what you're going through. And I know they would never come onto this podcast to talk about this. So that's why you guys
I would love to get them on, John. If we could ever get that to happen, that would be fantastic.
They're not going to do
that. Hey, maybe anyway. I can have them on my podcast and then maybe they'll be more willing to do it.
Exactly, exactly. Dan, for your kids that are much younger, the home is Prague.
Yeah, I mean, they were born here. They've only ever lived here. Yeah, so they have. I mean, they've traveled a lot when they were younger. I mean, they won't remember a lot of it, I don't think. But, you know, we spent 6 months in the Middle East and 6 months in Asia, and because I work remotely, so, you know, we've traveled a lot. So, but no, this is definitely their home. Yeah, I think it will be. I mean, we could move. It's possible. You know, we were, as you know, we were looking at moving to the Middle East recently. But for now, I think we're going to stay here, realistically.
Yeah, it's almost like home is a luxury in some ways, because if you look at kind of the geopolitical landscape that so many people are living, you know, homes taken away, homes destroyed, what is home? Absolutely. And how permanent is it, you know? And I think, you know, that kind of traditional idea of, I'm just thinking in where I grew up, most of the people I grew up with are no more there. I mean, there are very few that have stayed. They've all moved to other locations in Europe or the world. And I know in the United States, that's quite common that Americans tend to move a lot and don't stay within their close home. I don't know, Dan, in your own friend group, are they all still in Yorkshire?
Yeah, I'd say my university friends, my closest friends, almost all went to London, because kind of the UK, London's where you make the money, London's where all the job opportunities are. So they put it, and I went to London as well for 3 years. I wanted to get out. It was too big for me. But they're all pretty much in London, actually. Pretty much, not really Yorkshire. I went to university in Scotland. There's one or two in Scotland, but most of them are in London. And a couple in kind of big financial centers, Dubai, Hong Kong, things like that, Singapore. I know a couple of people there from school and university. But, you know, most people have gone for the, you know, most people I know, you know, have just gone for the money. They've gone for jobs in banking, consulting, things like that. You know, it's so that means you typically end up in the big cities.
Yeah. Dan, it's interesting. Yeah. You're kind of talking about professional professions.
Sure. Well, we're going to talk about educational and professional choices, and it's interesting to see how a third culture and international school background shapes one's life path. So, question for Julia, with your current master studies and your podcast, and Brogan, with your IT career, my career's been in IT as well, funnily enough. How are your experiences influenced by your international schooling, and what were the pivotal moments of reflection influenced by your personal experiences that steered you towards those paths? Long question, so pick whichever part you want.
Julia, you want to start?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, for me, so my master's now is in environmental science, and that has stemmed from almost a decade now worth of studies and passions and interests in science and nature. And that definitely stemmed from growing up in Singapore, like from being exposed to nature as a child, the tropical rainforest, the ocean surrounding the island, all of that was very interesting to me as a kid. But that might have happened no matter where I was. But I think it was more in high school where I was able to foster that interest into more of an academic sense. So at the American school, we had the choice to do advanced placement courses, AP courses, and there was AP environmental science. And so I took that in my grade 11 year, and that's where things kind of changed for me. It's like, oh, this isn't just something I'm passionate about, but I can also study this and make a career out of it. And so I did the course and then I did my bachelor's and now I'm doing my master's in environmental science. So really it was a trajectory that I was set on from a young age, and here we are, almost done. Maybe more school, I don't know.
Broken.
I think just in terms of education and career choices, you know, being in the international community, I don't know if it's influenced myself to a large degree. I mean, it has actually, in a way. I was able to land my first job in IT due to a connection made in the international community, funnily enough. But I wouldn't say it simply guided my interests, but I do know for a lot of people, I think a lot of my friends are going into international relations or trying to work at NGOs or, you know, diplomatic affairs. And I think that's a huge influence of that is growing up with an international perspective and being acutely aware of the world and the importance of big NGO organizations and what they do. Particularly, you know, a lot of families are from the UN or from the ILO and stuff like that, at least especially in Geneva. So I think that's definitely a big influence on people I know.
For sure.
And do you think that as international school students and TCKs, that community is a very rich community to build connections and then careers? Do you think, I mean, are you tapping into that group more than, say, if you were at a local high school in your home country? Do you find that, because if we think of the community of international schools, it's a generally quite a wealthy group of people, quite connected. You know, you were highlighting in your context of in Geneva, ILO, UN, and, you know, in Singapore, very likely the community, a lot of, CEOs and people doing companies or whatever. Do you think you're at a bigger advantage? And do you find leveraging that more than maybe what other peers that you know that don't have that experience? Go ahead, either of you. Go for it.
I definitely think there's an advantage. I think there's, also it's an opportunity. It's a privilege. I mean, yeah, like you said, there's no secret about it. You know, going to a national school, I guess generally, kind of as Dan, as you alluded to, would be higher tuition than local schools. And it just, the people who are there, you know, they're probably either working, big jobs in diplomatic positions or maybe even other sort of lucrative markets. And it does give you a good network if you want to build and leverage it. So yeah, we are, I mean, I personally am so very lucky to be part of that community.
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree. Definitely a privilege and definitely a very lucrative stance to be going to an international school. But I would also say for me on the personal side of things, being a child of international teachers, I would say that it's also personally benefited me because my parents' friends are teachers. They kind of were the people who also raised me in the sense they acted like aunts and uncles. And so now I also have this network of family in a way spread around the world. I can tap into that network, whether, maybe it is a job opportunity or I want to go travel somewhere and I have somewhere to stay because we have this net professional and personal network. And I think that's also very valuable in this globalized world and in this age of maybe people feeling more lonely or isolated because of the pandemic or the internet, but then having this strong international community has been very, very beneficial.
Yeah, absolutely. I know. I think all, and I appreciate both of you saying how much of a privilege it is because it's a unique privilege. And when you have these privileges, you also know there comes a certain responsibility too attached to it, you can, in that privileged position, you can actually do a lot of positive change. You know, very likely you will go to a social event and you start developing relationships and things like that. And not everybody that you're having relationships with has your trajectory or your experience. How is it making relationships when you come from a transient experience where you're good at making new relationships, but maybe those long-term relationships or just the dynamic of relationships might be more challenging? You both mentioned that, it was easy to go to university and settle in and we could quickly make friendships. We had that dexterity and agility. what might be some of the challenges? What are some things that maybe you feel you missed out on? And we don't, you know, it's not good to talk about regrets, but what might have been something you're saying, oh, relationships, this is what's challenging. Maybe we'll start with Julia.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think on the one hand, it is easy to have that frontward facing personality of like being friendly and easy to get to know people. But at the same time, because you yourself are transient and the people around you are transient, you kind of have to make a decision. Oh, do I want to go very deep with this person in the conversation you're having or in the relationship? Because there might be a, I don't know, expiry date on how long you're going to know this person before they leave or before you leave. I think that can be very challenging because not everybody wants to go that deep that quickly. So you might meet someone and you're asking more personal questions. You're getting to know someone really quickly, but almost in a way that maybe you scare them off. I'm not sure. It's happened to me before where, yeah, you go in too quickly and then it's not how everyone works. And so I think especially in going back to Canada, like when people in university are just like getting to know each other on a surface level and here you are coming in and asking like all these questions, like it can make you feel more isolated when you are maybe not fitting in the way that in the international community that you came from, people would have vibed with that really well because they were also on that same wavelength. And then you go into a more local community or a community that hadn't been so transient and it's a bit of a shock. So I think there is definitely a social aspect that can be challenging for TCKs.
Yeah, I like that anecdote where you might go in too fast or not enough, you know, trying to measure the temperature of that dynamic of the relationship.
And then they're like, well.
Yeah. Why are you asking all these questions?
Yeah.
Rogan? You're on mute.
Sorry about that. No, I think Julie definitely hit the nail on the head with it. I think there is, you know, you try and kind of coax that, like, get rid of that notion, but there is something in the back of your head that always says, you know, oh, this person might leave or this person might not be in my life for that long. And that's just a function of experience that's kind of built into your subconscious when you approach relationships. I definitely think it was always, for me, at least, I would gravitate kind of naturally towards people who are from the international community, be it in university or elsewhere. You kind of find a little bit more commonality with people who have traveled a lot or grew up abroad or grew up in different cultures.
Yeah, I think that's a really strong point of reference. I think myself also. Dan, I mean, in your work also, I mean, don't you think even both of us in our professional careers were gravitating towards people that are international more than anything?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Yeah. I think it goes without saying, you know, you live in that environment for long enough, you tend to have more in common with people that are like that and have international experiences and that open, kind of open-minded, not that people who don't travel are not open-minded, but there's a, you know, the concept of international mindedness, you know, is really strong in that crowd.
Yeah, and I think also it's they understand you. So if you say, oh, I went skiing in Austria for the February break, and then the summer I was in Spain, you say that at your local, you know, in a local village or local neighborhood in a city where nobody's moved, they're looking at you like, what are you talking about, you know? And how do you share your personal experiences in a context that maybe doesn't have that point of reference? And I think that always is where you have to almost kind of curate, say, okay, I'm just going to talk about the local soccer game because I know everybody in this mm-hmm. environment understands that. And we can have that conversation and nobody's going to feel odd or uncomfortable. I know for myself, when I went to a university in Ohio, which was a state university, and there were not many international school people, I quickly understood the disadvantage of not having the cultural innuendos associated with television.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. That was, I really felt that there were just certain And, you know, I'm in that generation that I'm at, those television shows were quite significant in guiding and almost stamping your identity and how you associated. And that was, I was at a huge disadvantage when I was in a social situation and people would refer to some social television event or some sporting event or that, you know, passion for a team. All those things make it much more harder to gravitate. And what I personally found was music was where I could, that was kind of the commonality, you know, music, the music we were listening to here in Europe was very likely in many ways similar. You know, the bigger artists were also very popular. And that was kind of the common ground that I found. But I definitely found the television and some of the culture, the clothing and what was hip and not, was definitely quite difficult to navigate. I don't know, Dan, have you had that experience or Brogan and Julia? Love to hear your respective thoughts on that.
Yeah. I'd love to hear from you guys. What do you guys think?
I mean, it's funny you know, bringing up TV shows and that kind of the soft cultural stuff, because I know for me here, I'm a huge football or soccer fan. And, you know, it's like obviously a cliche, but you meet somebody at the pub, especially, you know, a group of dudes, let's say, it's quite easy to bond over sports, you know. So moving to Canada was a bit funny because I know nothing about hockey, having not grown up in Canada. So I didn't kind of have that, you know, center point to bond with people over. Like, you watch a hockey game? I'm like, no idea what's going on. So yeah, it was something to adapt to as well.
Julia, yeah, how about you?
Sorry, John.
No, go ahead, Dan.
I mean, it's always like, you know, since I was young, I was always traveling. I got jobs abroad from like very young age, even when I was a teenager, young teenager. And so I kind of like, I find often when I talk about, like, you know, you talk about, I've been doing this, I've just been skiing in Austria, I've been doing this. And it kind of sounds like lifestyles of the rich and famous. But I think I personally learned from a very young age that you don't need much money to do good stuff if you don't mind, you know, roughing it and things like that. So I always had good experiences. But when you're with people who haven't done things like that, it sounds like you're kind of boasting, oh, I do this. And so I tend not to talk about it, just exactly what you said. You know, I tend to just keep, if I'm with people who are from that environment, I will just talk about the rugby or whatever, you know.
Definitely. I think it's easier just to stay quiet sometimes. Like, you don't want to bring attention to yourself, whether that's a story you're talking about or not understanding a pop culture reference, so you just sit there kind of clueless anyways. Definitely happened to me a lot. But beyond just music or sports, for me, another challenge was the weather, since Singapore is like 30 degrees, 100% humidity all year round. And then I moved back to Canada with snow and winter, not having really dealt with that before. That was something I was a bit clueless to the point where in the first year of my university, we got a huge snowfall, like right before exams. And I was woken up by the machines taking away the snow in the morning. And I go to all my friends and I was like, guys, are you woken up by these snow bulldozers? And they're like, yeah, I guess. And I kept going all day being like, these snow bulldozers kept waking me up. And then finally, at the end of the day, someone's like, do you mean a snow plow? Like, is that what you mean? Because I just like totally didn't have the language for it and like didn't think of an actual term for these machines taking away the snow. So I kind of embarrassed myself in the first year of university. But you live and you learn.
Yeah, I those are moments. And I think for a lot of TCKs, there are moments where you're embarrassed and you quickly, as you said, Julia, you quickly learn, maybe I'm just going to keep low key and quiet and kind of get the temperature of the place before I start engaging, or finding a point of entry that you feel more confident to engage with. And that definitely can be challenging.
Great. John, shall I jump into the cultural sensitivity?
Yeah, I'm curious what they're going to say.
It's a great question from John. I have to give John the credit for these questions and the two of you. It wasn't me, they're very good. So with the broad perspective gained from your experiences, including international school education, How do you reflect on your cultural awareness? Do you ever question the depth of this understanding? Is there a possibility that third culture children's cultural sensitivity is to some extent superficial or romanticized? And how might this play a role in your day-to-day interactions? Great question, John.
Brogan, you want to start?
I think it's hard to answer a question with a question. I'm quite interested what you mean by superficial or romanticized.
That's fair enough. I think sometimes people assume because you've traveled a lot and you've lived in different cultures that you're far more sensitive and far more culturally aware. And personally, I'm not convinced, because I think especially in international schools, the cultural awareness is very much UN Day, United Nation Week of Food, let's wear our costumes. And I'm being very generalizing. Schools do a much better job today, definitely. Don't get me wrong. But I'm wondering how culturally sensitive and aware we are when we're jumping around in this very kind of bubble of international education and international TCKs. I think that's where I'm coming from, Brogan.
Okay. Yeah, I think, I mean, my personal view on it is, I think being part of the TCK or international community, I think you probably be able to have a better base level, but I don't think it's necessarily a given that everyone who's grown up in international community would be super culturally aware. I know a lot of people who grew up in many different countries and just who are not that culturally aware. I think it depends on a lot of things, a lot of factors, upbringing. I think, yeah, so to answer your question, you probably would have a little bit, maybe marginally more, but it's not an outright indicator of someone being culturally sensitive or aware.
Julia?
Yeah, this is actually something I've reflected on a lot as a young adult, especially as I started my podcast and I wanted to dive deeper into the topic of third culture kids and read literature about it and listen to other people talk about their experiences, not just a cis white woman who went to a international school of the language that I spoke. Like, I wanted to hear more about it. And so actually I read some of the work of Danau Tanu, who was a PhD scholar who went back to Indonesia where she grew up to, I think, Indonesian and Chinese parents, and really talked about how westernized and like the white perspective was really brought into the international school, and really not the other perspectives of the other students or Indonesia where the school was based. And I think that is true of a lot of schools. And I think you're really right, John, in the sense that it's almost like in environmental science, we have greenwashing where they say that it's green when it's really not. I feel like in the way it's sometimes the international community or the international schools can say they're international, but it's almost just something they say instead of really diving into what that means, or like really bringing that to the forefront of their curriculum, especially in international schools, or into their activities, or even bringing in local voices. So yeah, I think it's something that is maybe becoming better, like you said, but I think it's something that international schools can improve on for sure.
I think it was Ruth, and Ruth, I'm sure, is going to listen to this, so I apologize if I'm wrong, but she talked about a student in an Asian school that used to go home, and when she was home, she never asked questions because the culture did not allow her to ask questions. That was not the relationship. But when she was in the IBTOK, it was all about questions. So basically, she had she had to engage in two different spheres and switch between them. And there was no midpoint. And I think so often, as you said, and we've had different guests have highlighted that this kind of white imperialism or colonialism of international schools is this idea, we're coming, we're the international schools, we're going to help the local orphanage, and then we're all going to go home. And, we had Leanne Lavender talk about that. We've had a few guests highlight that. So I think that's the provocation that I'm trying, and it sounds like it's resonating. I think you are, and Brogan, that's a great term, a baseline. I think you have a better baseline.
Absolutely.
But that doesn't give you carte blanche to say you're culturally sensitive. And the fact is, most international schools, even if you go to an international school in Asia where there's a large percentage of Asian kids, they're going to want a very Western education because they very likely want to go to those Ivy League schools or universities in North America, Australia, New Zealand. And so there is that kind of arc over us that's very much a Western perspective that I think must be really hard for the TCKs that are not with us today, that are not from Canada, but might be from Chad, or might be from Brunei, or wherever it might be, and you know, what do they juggle with in their cultural tension? I don't know if you, if that resonates.
Yeah, like I feel very lucky that I didn't have that tension in that way with like not having a difference between my home life and my school life. They're very much intertwined and very much assimilated, especially having my parents be teachers. It was all one sphere, really. And so, yeah, I feel very lucky that I didn't have to also balance that.
It's interesting. Sorry, John.
No, no, go ahead. Sorry.
I've mentioned this before in the pod, but I think there's a bigger problem with cultural sensitivity than just the, you know, I agree with everything you guys have said, but I think there's a bigger problem that no one talks about, which I've brought up again, which is the problem with international schools is you don't know any poor people, you know, because if I look at I'll compare my upbringing to my kids' upbringing, you know, like I went to a state school. So there was all kinds of, you know, all kinds of income levels of people there. There were people who were wealthy. There was plenty of people who lived in like social housing. And I'm not saying it was like a great experience all the time, you know, it wasn't at all, you know, but I think my kids will probably be more comfortable dealing with, you know, higher income people than it took me till I went to university to kind of be moving those kind of circles, but they won't have the experience of knowing kind of, I hate to say regular people, but you know, people, you know, who couldn't afford to send their kids to an international school. And I think no one talks about it, but it's an issue. You know, you're in a certain income, you know, there's different types of students at international schools. Some kids, you know, their parents might be teachers, or maybe their company's paying for them to join. Some are children of entrepreneurs, some are from NGOs, but it's all generally, you know, educated kind of people. So I think that's I don't know what you guys think of that point.
What are your thoughts about, I think Dan has brought this up a few times, and thank you, Dan, for doing that, because I think we forget sometimes. Yeah. Nobody talks about it. Yeah, it's kind of the elephant in the room. So, Dan, I know you brought that up a couple times with other guests, and I think people tend to stay away from it I'm not going to go down that road. But Brogan's going to engage with it.
Exactly. Great. That's what I like. Good to see.
No, I mean, I think it's a great point. And I think, you know, as you guys were talking about it, I could help reflect on the fact that you know, at least me, myself, and a lot of my peers, we grew up in a national environment in what is already considered a very wealthy country, in a very insular country in Switzerland, you know. So it's kind of almost like a double whammy. Even the life outside of the national schools tend to be filled with a lot of people who are high income people, or at least living in a very stable social setting. So yeah, while we are learning about all these things in school, we're not really taught, I guess, and it's hard to teach it really, so to speak, realities of life and how people are in a more regular city, let's say. That's not Geneva, that's not Singapore, that's outside of this kind of global international financial hub.
Julia, how do you, with that provocation?
Absolutely. Like, Singapore is the same. It's a huge metropolitan city in Asia. And although I think you, once you left the international school bubble, you might have seen a bit more, I guess, class divide or people of lower income than maybe you would in Switzerland, at least maybe that you're interacting with in the environment. It's still very much, wealthy place. And so I think, like Brogan said, it's something hard to teach, but I think students need to be more, yeah, culturally and financially aware of that. It needs to be not the elephant in the room. It needs to be taught. So also when they go off to university or they do go to other places in the world, they aren't that ignorant international kid just coming into the room and not being aware of other people's situations or even reflecting on their own and allowing them to be humble instead of arrogant.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. When I went to this university in Ohio, it was the first time that I actually realized some people took loans out to go to universities. And some of the students that I were my peers definitely come from backgrounds where their parents were on food stamps, you know, where there was socioeconomic pressures at a level that I had no point of reference. And I remember socializing and getting to know that dynamic. And it was, I was just, yeah, it was, it just showed how disconnected I was from reality and how privileged I was. And that privilege is almost what's, and I think, Dan, thank you for bringing this up, is what are we doing to develop that awareness and those bridges? Because we are in this bubble, and I was in this bubble, and suddenly I'm in this small community in Ohio. And I remember going for a Thanksgiving meal with one of my roommates, and yeah, we went to a town in southern Ohio where there's immense poverty. And it was just, yeah, I had no point of reference that I could even digest what I was seeing. And it wasn't that I was, it was a negative experience. It was just that gap. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure. And I think, Brogan, you alluded to it. It's hard to teach it, but somehow we have to develop an awareness. I think that's what you're saying, Dan, right? Is that we have to be more candid about this.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I mean, it doesn't matter what your background is. You know, I was from like a middle class area, so it wasn't the same as going to like an inner city school where it was like super rough. I mean, whatever background you're from, you're going to hang out with different kinds of people, you know? So exactly. It's going to know, you know, the person who goes to the inner city school isn't going to hang out with the kids whose parents work for the UN, you know? So they're not going to have that. And the person who goes to, you know, International School of Geneva isn't probably going to know the people that live in social housing. So know what, you know, I think it's good for whatever type of background you're from to try to get to meet people from different environments. I think it only helps you have empathy for people and it helps you in your own career as well. Cause in the real world, you have to interact with all kinds of people, you know?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Do you think, Julia and Brogan, is this something that you're aware of, or this is something that as you've gotten older and gone into situations that are not as TCK in your professional and in your postgraduate studies, you suddenly are saying, wow, I need to be a little more aware of that?
I think for me, it was more so apparent when I was in Montreal. So I think moving back here and professional life has mostly been in Switzerland. I think in Montreal it was really something I learned that, yeah, I mean, we went on ski trips during school, you know, part of our school kind of field trips, which I think a lot of people wouldn't have access to. And I think among the right people, when you get to know somebody well, you can kind of bring it up jokingly. But yeah, I think as we've spoken about before, you kind of hold that side of the experience back. And yeah, I think, you know, I definitely met a lot of people and were friends with a lot of people from different kind of income backgrounds. And it wasn't brought up a lot. But yeah, like you said, you'd hear someone say, oh, they have to pay a loan, or they're working a second job, which I know a lot of people that I grew up with never had to do that sort of thing, you know, and yeah, and here it's definitely less. There's still people who you meet who, you know, definitely came from very different backgrounds, very harsher backgrounds. Yeah, I guess it's less apparent in Switzerland, to be honest.
Julia?
Yeah, I'd say the same, definitely returning to Canada for studies, like that's where you were really meeting people from all types of backgrounds and not just this international school bubble. So it was, yeah, like an awareness to be more mindful of how people grew up and listening to people's stories too, not just wanting to share your story, but listening to others. I think that's a huge skill that I've learned over the years and I just enjoyed getting to know more people, as in, not just in the spirit of, in the international school setting, but also just everyone in all of life. So.
Cool. Well, listen, Brogan and Julia, thank you so much. This has been so rich, and we really appreciate it, because we've had a lot of theorists and people that are helping families, and it's just so nice to have two young adults that have gone through that experience. And I want to remind people that Julia and Brogan have added some show notes, and of course, you have a link to Julia's podcast. So definitely make a point of subscribing to her podcast. What we usually do at the end is we ask if you could give any advice to a school leader or a teacher, an educational international educator, what might that advice be, or something you want them to walk away with. Can I start with you, Julia?
Sure. Yes. I think both growing up in an international school setting, but also from having teacher parents, like, I have a lot of reflection on this question, actually, and being a young adult TCK now, I think I would say to teachers or heads of schools that I think they prepare students very well academically to go off to university, but maybe not the best socially in what we've talked about today. But I think they could do better in providing those, like, soft skills of what they might need when they go off to university, and how to interact with people outside of the international school bubble, or even how to navigate homesickness or being away from your family, all of these things I think schools maybe need to work on. So yeah, if teachers can do better at that, the academic side, they did a great job, but socially they could, I think young adults and kids leaving international schools could use a bit more support.
Thank you. Brogan?
Yeah, I mean, I think Julia summarized my thoughts perfectly. I think my advice to educators of international school kids, outside of less homework, burst that bubble. I think I felt I was a recipient of a very great education. I had some lovely teachers who, guided me both academically and, on a just a personal human growth level. But I definitely think we are in a bubble. And if teachers, I don't know how you do it, but can strive to help kids pop that bubble and expand, their awareness, then they probably come out of international education an even more well-rounded person.
Fantastic. Thank you. Wonderful pieces of guidance and advice from both of you. Dan, any clothing thoughts?
I really enjoyed that chat. Thanks, Julia and Brogan. John, I've got a quick question for you. I was just thinking of as we were talking, like, I know a lot of people who work for international schools whose parents also did. Like, curious, like, just was thinking about this. How many of your, like, colleagues and things you've worked with, their kids have kind of gone into the same lifestyle of working for international schools and traveling around? Is it a lot, a few, what does it look like?
I recently have met more, and I don't know why. When I was in other parts of the world, I wasn't bumping into staff members who were international school students and kids. But yeah. Here, I have bumped into far more, which is interesting. And we actually had Stefan and Matt, who were third generation. Their parents were international school educators. They're international school educators. And their kids are now in the same international school. And they were all at the same building and same school, which is just amazing, over 40 years. Yeah, Julia, you wanted to bring up something on that topic.
Yeah, actually, on my podcast, I interviewed a third culture kid therapist. So someone who specializes, a therapist who specializes in working with adult third culture kids. And she studied this specific topic, looking at the correlation between people who grew up as TCKs and then their trajectory into adulthood and if they returned overseas. And even looking at the subcategory of kids who grew up in international schools becoming teachers themselves. And there is some correlation or some, I think, drive for kids to, I don't know, go back into that maybe expat bubble, maybe even were examples. I don't know. I went and studied it in Switzerland for my master's. Like, I don't know. I think there is something to that end for sure.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, and I think this is such a huge topic that's still being studied, and things have changed also. Now you have third culture kids from India and China and Indonesia that have no connection to the Western world, and they're third generation living abroad. Or I know, having lived in Japan, a lot of Japanese kids that had lived abroad coming back into the Japanese school system was quite intense, and there was quite a steep learning curve, and also, you know, all those questions we haven't even come into, but that's a whole other topic. And, you know, we need to be mindful, especially to our audience. We've been very kind of international school with a bit of a white centric lens, but there's much more out there, and we need to understand that. And those are topics that we can unpack again. Well, thank you both for sharing your wisdom and being part of this. This is really kind of you, and we look forward to hearing and being in touch. And next, we'll have dance kids when they turn 16. And,
exactly.
Well, thank you both for inviting us on the podcast as well.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you. I remember everybody, the show notes, Julia and Brogan shared some stuff on there. And thank you again for all your comments and likes on LinkedIn, Dan. We're getting a lot of traffic. And
We've had a bonanza. We got voted the best education podcast, which is kind of, I don't think it's true. I don't know how it happened.
It's true. This happens periodically, and you and I are like, where is that coming from? Nobody talked to us. It's the algorithm. Somebody hacked the algorithm. Whoever did that, thank you. Anyway, all the best. Look forward to chatting soon, Dan. Cheers.
Yes.